everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Spellman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. And this is a show that is dedicated to empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed choices possible regarding your hormones, your health, your overall well-being. And it is such a pleasure to have you join me for another enlightening show today. We are going to be discussing a topic that I think is personally very fascinating, and it's understanding more about our brain and how to enhance it. I actually have titled this show, Your Brain Rejuvenation and Meditation, which is, you know, I hope Dr. Fred Travis will appreciate that title. But I find that the research that is going on is absolutely fascinating to give us a greater appreciation of the power that exists within us, particularly the power that exists within this part of our body called the brain, and all of the capacities that we can access when we learn how to use this phenomenal resource that we all were born with. What does it mean? How can it support us with our health, with rejuvenation, with increasing our capacity to be more of who we are as we journey through this life, and even affecting our genes and just about everything. So we're going to have a conversation that's going to go from, in a sense, cradle to grave, because we're going to look at what's happening with our children, what's happening with us as we move into the phase of our life that lets us be successful in our work and relationships, and we can go all the way out into the expanded universe. I'm sure my guest today, Dr. Fred Travis, will have so much fascinating information to share with us, because this is his focus. This is his work. He is the author of Your Brain is a River, Not a Rock, and Dr. Fred Travis is professor of Maharishi Vedic Sciences, chair of the Department of Maharishi Vedic Science, dean of the Graduate School, and director of the Center for Brain Consciousness and Cognition. He earned an MS and PhD in psychology from the Maharishi University of Management, and he is a world expert on understanding and appreciating and enhancing our brain and expanded centers of consciousness. So, Dr. Fred Travis, welcome to the show today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Cheryl.
Well, I hope I got it right. You are our brain expert, right?
It's funny to be called an expert, but I have, for the last 23 years, looked at how meditation practice affects brain development, natural brain development in children, how it helps us buffer the effects of stress, and how brain changes during meditation practice can support growth of higher states of consciousness.
Well, we have a lot to talk about. As I said, we'll be going through those different aspects of children and with our health and with, you know, higher states of consciousness. I'm all for that. And one meditation really is something that our culture should really embrace and take seriously, because it just enhances the quality of our life. And rather than being a nanu-nanu thing that some people think meditation, I don't know what people think about meditation, because I've been meditating in one form or another for decades, but I think it's, you know, it's not so bizarre to a Western mind anymore, and there's so much fascinating research that is emerging showing how different forms of meditation can absolutely improve the quality of our life, our healing, our relationships, our children's lives. So you know, you have spent so many years researching this. I'm just kind of going to let you begin this conversation and share with us, well, maybe share with us some of the most impressive research that you've been involved with or that is emerging that is giving us a new appreciation of what meditation and what meditation accesses within us for our quality of life and well-being.
Excellent. That's a big full picture. What has happened is two things have come together. That's the awakening of modern science to the fact that the brain is a river and not a rock. That your brain, actually 70% of your brain connections change every day.
Wow.
So those people that are listening now to this radio show, listening, thinking about it, reflecting on other experiences they have, they're actually using and strengthening different connections. So this is one whole understanding that what we're doing is we're actually consciously sculpting our brain by our conscious decisions. Because the decisions we have for a specific experience, of course, lead to flood of activation over the brain to give you that experience. But then those circuits you use are strengthened. And so that means next time you're in a similar situation, you're going to be more inclined to see it in that way. And this is positive. This is how we've been able to adapt to living from Alaska to Florida to the Siberian tundra. The brain is just able to see and respond and learn what we have to do there. So that's one whole piece. The second whole piece is, while Western science has been looking deeply into matter and what's underneath objects, what's underneath behavior of classical objects around us, the Eastern traditions have asked, what's underneath our thoughts? Where do our thoughts come from? How can our thoughts be stronger? How can our thoughts be more accurate? And what they developed is techniques of meditation that explore inner consciousness. And so we have meditation techniques which just give us different experiences, and we have the understanding in neuroscience that experiences change the brain. So they come together. And what modern science knows is meditations are giving different types of experience. We should expect that they will be affecting the brain, and then we should look at them in greater detail.
You know, I remember seeing, I guess it was part of a documentary, when they were wiring up a long-term meditator, so kind of check his functional brain patterns. And what people think is that when you meditate and calm down and get centered, that your brain activity is going to calm down. But in actual fact, the opposite occurs, isn't it? I mean, that's what this, in the documentary they were showing, you actually have more activity, more connections going on when you are in that receptive inner place, which is, I would imagine, it means that we can open up to more creative ideas, more solutions, more insight. Well, that's my thoughts on it, but you're the expert. What do you have to say about that?
But this is bringing up the next important question, and that is, now we have these meditation techniques, are they all the same? And I think they share the desire to explore consciousness, but their angles for exploring consciousness are different. Mm-hmm. And what that means very simply is different procedures are used. Some use focus control of the mind, like Zen, like compassion meditation. In these meditations, you have one goal of meditation, and you use your mind to try to get to that goal. Now, when you're doing this type of meditation, I think this is the one you're referring to, what you find is that the brain is actually functioning very fast. The brain waves go up and down 20 to 50 times per second. It's called gamma, DEG. You see gamma whenever you focus. Gamma is created by short-range connections in the brain, and what you're doing is you're taking the whole field of incoming information and breaking it into the most important parts. And so experience changes the brain, so if you focus in your meditation, you'll find you'll be better able to focus your attention after meditation. But there are other types of meditation that don't try to control the mind, but rather they just allow all experiences to go through awareness. It's called dispassionate observation. Mindfulness meditation is an example of this, or Kriya Yoga. And what these meditations are doing is that they're giving you a different training. Rather than training you to focus the mind, to hold the mind steady, they're training you to watch, to not be caught up in the experience, to see how experiences change. This has its own value, and what it does is it brings that value of being more mindful into activity. You won't be so caught up in arguments and so on. Now, meditations in these first two categories, the first one, you, as I mentioned, you see gamma EEG, and the second, open monitoring, the brainwave you see is called theta. It goes up and down 6 to 8 times per second. And it's seen whenever your attention is turned within and you're following internal mental processing. Now, these meditations all involve doing, creating cognitive tools or attentional set during the meditation to have afterwards, to be able to use in daily life afterwards. There's a third category of meditation, though, which is unique in two ways. While the meditations and focused attention open monitoring involve creating mental tools, meditations in this third category, automatic self-transcending, don't develop an attentional set or behavioral coping mechanism or any mental tool, but rather leads to a change of mental set, a change in the mind, a change in orientation and experience of who you are. Meditations and automatic self-transcending start with thinking, and then they end up with being. They end up with going beyond thoughts and categories and processes and just experiencing the wakeful state, which is underlying all thoughts. It's that wakeful state from which thoughts come. And so you talked about inner calm and so on. What's important is a state of automatic self-transcending. There is a rest there, because the mind is completely quiet, but there's a highly alert value as well. It's restful alertness. This is seen in two ways. In terms of the brainwave, you see that there's alpha EEG. It goes up and down 8 to 10 times per second. It's seen whenever the attention is turned within and you're just awake. In terms of blood flow, what you find is there's increased blood flow to the front of the brain. The front of the brain are the executive centers of the brain. Decreased blood flow to the brainstem. It's a part of the brain that has to do with activation or stereotypical response and so on. So meditations and automatic self-transcending, such as transcendental meditation, what you're doing is not creating a new tool, but you're taking the mind to inner transcendence, the state of restful alertness. And what that does, it gives you a different orientation to life when you come out. By analogy, if we think of the mind as a tool, it's like a knife. And you can learn how to use the knife in different ways, how to hold it, how to cut, and so on. And by analogy, this is what meditations and focused attention and open monitoring are doing. They're teaching you how to use the mind differently. Meditations and automatic self-transcending, such as transcendental meditation, doesn't teach you how to use the knife in a different way, but rather you stop using the knife and you sharpen it. And now, once the knife is sharpened, however you use it, it's going to be more effective. So similarly, when you take the mind to the transcendent, the source of thought, which is just alert, awake, alive, vital, highly creative, when you come out of meditation, that's the mind you bring with you into every situation you're in. And I think this is why there's been such substantial benefits seen through transcendental meditation practice, seen through this process of transcending. For instance, in blood pressure, transcendental meditation has been found to decrease blood pressure significantly more than other meditations, to the effect that the American Heart Association is recommending that doctors say to their patients that they should investigate transcendental meditation. Other meditations haven't found to affect blood pressure. Other things, post-traumatic stress. Experience changes the brain, and one traumatic stress can permanently turn on the amygdala, the fear centers of the brain. And it's very hard to turn it off, because once that fear center is on, that's coloring and processing everything you see. But allowing the mind to transcend, it seems to turn off the amygdala. It turn off the fear center. Research, random assignment research, we found in just 10 days of TM practice, there were clinically significant improvements in post-traumatic stress symptoms. After 30 days, these subjects were down to non-symptomatic.
Can we just stop at that point? Because post-traumatic stress is emerging as a serious problem, not just because we know that this is occurring to so many of the recurring soldiers from Afghanistan and Iraq, but childhood trauma also is a source of post-traumatic stress, and we see certainly lots of trauma in children. in abusive families of various sorts. And this is such a serious problem. Can we talk a little bit more about some of the concerns of post-traumatic stress? You were talking about its effect on the amygdala. So just people can understand, what are some of the signs and symptoms if you are dealing with post-traumatic stress? And then we can talk about some of the solutions, because medicating people with post-traumatic stress is not a solution, really.
I agree. Yes, and at any time, Cheryl, just jump in if I'm going on too long.
Okay, I will. Trust me. Well, you've got so much, you know, great information. I just want to be sure we kind of pick out lots of pearls and maybe expand upon them.
Perfect. Thank you. Yeah, so what it is, again, what is the amygdala? It's in the core of the brain. It's a natural response that the brain uses to tag potential experiences that could be life-threatening. It's a natural response. We use it all the time. We walk down the road. We see that street lights are off on the next two blocks. The amygdala goes off, and you think, maybe I shouldn't go down there. But it's there to protect us from potential harm. What happens with post-traumatic stress is this natural response is responding to an unnatural situation. Trauma is an unnatural situation. War is an unnatural situation where people are killing people. And what the amygdala does is, in very traumatic situations, it tags every aspect of it because it never wants to be there. And what it ends up being is it's permanently on. And so now every experience you have, it's as though it's a threat to your survival. So what happens is you're hypervigilant. What happens is you can't trust people. What happens is you're not able to flow in a loving relationship. You go back and you see your children and you think, what would they think of me when they hear what I've done? You're not able to sleep. Your whole priorities have been turned upside down. Suddenly the concerns of a day-to-day routine job on the plant are not as real to you as the very deep personal experiences you're having on the battlefield. So this is, and what happens is suicidal thoughts come up. Why did I survive and my best friend die? It's called survivor guilt. Why do I have two legs and two arms where my best friend lost his arm and his eye? There's a process of trying to integrate and digest all of that, but we're in a situation back home and where we don't really understand what they're going through. So often veterans turn to drugs, alcohol, hard drugs, just as a way to get away from the suicidal thoughts, to get away from this constant racing of the mind. It's almost as though you're driving a car where the accelerator is pushed down and you're pushing the brake at the same time. The amygdala is one of the key parts of the limbic system, emotional system. It's just permanently on and you're trying to hold it under guard. And so the reason drugs do not work, the reason that most talk therapies are only partially successful, is because they're dealing with a symptom and not the cause. They're dealing with the suicidal thoughts and not the actual cause of the suicidal thoughts. And I think the reason transcendental meditation does work is it gives a new experience. You step out of thoughts and categories and words and past experience, and you just are. You're awake. You're alert. You're full. You're silent. You're whole. And this is, it's an experience you're having. It's not an intellectual affirmation. It's the experience you're having. And then when you come out, what the veterans who have started TM tell me is their suicidal thoughts just stop. Hmm. They're able now to relate to their family. They're able to sleep. And I'm raising money now to actually do the neural imaging research so we can see how the brain is actually changed. Because we see these behavioral effects in 10 days to 30 days. I'm very sure it's a process of transcending, giving a new experience, and through neuroplasticity, that experience is changing the brain.
Have you done some imaging on some of these returning vets? And I just have to say that, you know, post-traumatic stress syndrome could be occurring in our children, or if women have been in abusive situations, abusive marriages. There's so many, any extreme stress, and it probably doesn't need to be going on for very long, does it, Fred, to have that effect on the brain?
Yeah, actually, the whole focus is on veterans, but women have twice the incidence of post-traumatic stress.
Yeah.
As men do. Children as well, there's a lot of thinkers that theorize that it's the stress and abuse that happens in children that actually gives rise to mental problems as adults.
Yeah.
Even things like attention deficit hyperactive disorder. This is Gabor Mate's thinking. And so it's interesting, post-traumatic stress it's a lifestyle disease. It doesn't come from a bacteria or a virus. You can't vaccinate people against it. It's a lifestyle disease. And I think the only way to really deal with it is by changing the lifestyle, by giving a new experience. And then as the brain is changed to give rise to post-traumatic stress, so the brain can then as if go back or return to balance, normality.
Well, that's really inspiring and encouraging to all those people who are suffering with post-traumatic stress, because it is a huge problem in our society, and there really aren't very many effective modalities that can resolve it, you know, and as you were saying, and I believe that medication will never resolve it. It could just exacerbate problems. But through the work of meditation, and particularly the work you've been doing with transcendental meditation, you've seen results. So I wanted to ask you, have you taken some brain scans already of before and after with post-traumatic stress victims?
Not yet. I have a collaborator at a neural imaging lab who's ready to go ahead. I just have to get the funding to put everything together.
Right. Well, that would be so interesting. So out of curiosity, because I know you've been involved with the Maharishi University, very involved, and you are practicing transcendental meditation yourself, does the university or does the organization offer programs for veterans to help them?
It's a very good question. At the university, all students learn transcendental meditation as part of going to school here. And then all students sit and meditate together. Well, they meditate on their own in the morning. They meditate at the end of class in the afternoon. So on that level, we have many of our students are vets. There's a push to make this more available because veterans want to get an education. They can come here and get an education as well as learn transcendental meditation to help their post-traumatic stress symptoms. So that's just coming out. There are other organizations. Warrior Wellness is one, which is actively approaching veterans, and it's veterans approaching veterans and telling them about the effects of TM practice, the effects of transcending to help post-traumatic stress symptoms. Mm. So that's going on.
Right.
And in probably a year or two, we'll have a program specifically for veterans. And it'll be a program for them that we realize that they need additional help, probably study skills, getting into the routine, dealing with the transition from post-traumatic stress symptoms and those becoming less. But that's definitely in the work, Cheryl.
Good. It would just seem to follow. There's such a need, and if you have a modality that is so effective, it needs to be widely available to people, you know. And I know that there's so much research that goes on at the Maharishi University to demonstrate the effectiveness of, you know, that particular meditation technique. Although I'm sure all meditation techniques would be of benefit. They, like you were saying, they work in little different ways of the brain, and you can see that with brain scans, but anything that's going to help support our awareness is going to be beneficial to us. So, you know, I just encourage people to start, you know, find a path and just pursue it, because it's going to be of great benefit. And I want you to talk about children and how you are working with children in meditation and some of the results you're seeing with that population.
Right, yeah, so we've looked at attention deficit hyperactive disorder in children. We've also looked at, let's talk about normal children, because children come into the world with their brain unassembled. They have the brain cells, the brain neurons are there, but they're not fully connected. And over the first 20 years of life, these connections are created. So there's a lot of transformations going on in children. And two studies have looked at the effect of transcendental meditation for children. It's a special technique they do from age 5 to 10. And then age 10, they can close their eyes and transcend like adults. And these two studies found that cognitive development in the meditating children was smoother, was faster. It resolved much more quickly. And this is, again, another instance of experience changing the brain. And in this case, the experience of inner silence, of wholeness, of a sense of self within who's stable and alert, awake, just aids in the development up through Piaget's cognitive stages. So we've looked at normal children. We've also looked at children with attention deficit hyperactive disorder. In this population, they have problems with impulse control. They have problems with attention regulation. And on one level, you may ask, well, how can they meditate? How can they sit in one place? And indeed, when we sent this research out for publication, that's what one of the reviewers said. They said, these kids, because we said they would come together, practice their transcendental meditation in the morning and in the afternoon at the school. And they said, now, these kids, if they're in a room and they're together, they don't have ADHD. ADHD children are just, they're just always playing with each other and bouncing and anyways. And it brought out a very key point, and that is that the way transcendental meditation is conducted is it's not involving individual inception, individual intellectual ability, individual control of the mind, but rather it uses the natural tendency of the mind. And the natural tendency of the mind is just the big problem for kids with ADHD. The natural tendency of the mind is curiosity, is growth, is expansion. And with transcendental meditation, you learn how to turn the attention within and then use that same natural tendency to allow the mind to settle down. So this is how these kids with attention deficit hyperactive disorder could close their eyes. They could transcend. That is, the mind to become more and more quiet, so there's less content, there's less thinking, feeling, perceptions, and there's in the underlying wakefulness, wholeness, silence within which everything is put together becomes more predominant. I remember one girl came out of her first meditation and she opened up her eyes and said, this is a whole new world. Because her mind had never been quiet before. It just had been going 100 miles an hour. So what we found, this was a random assignment study. It was at a school which was developed and geared for children with learning disabilities, so it was with special teachers and curricula and so on. And we randomly assigned children aged 10 to 14 to learn transcendental meditation or delayed start. They just had their usual care and instruction at the school. And what we found is the brain measure of attention deficit hyperactive disorder. The brain measure is one frequency, the theta frequency, over another frequency, beta. Theta is what happens when your attention is turned within. Kids with attention deficit hyperactive disorder, the theta is so high that they block everything out. You call their name, it doesn't reach their conscious awareness. And also they're not able to control focus, and so beta is very low. So this theta-beta ratio, which is actually recognized now as a measure of severity of attention deficit hyperactive disorder, we found that this decreased over the 3 months of the first group who learned TM, and in the second group who did not learn TM, it actually went up a bit. And after 3 months, the delayed start group got to learn transcendental meditation. For the last 3 months of the study, everyone was meditating. And what we found is everyone's theta-beta ratio started to go towards normality. We also did a different score to see how the brain was functioning as a whole. Because the way the brain puts things together is it takes the individual output of all the individual modules in the brain and it puts them together temporarily to integrate everything. And that's how we're able to have an idea and not jump up and blurt it out, but think about it and develop it and then over time actually bring it out. And what we found is over the 3 months of transcendental meditation practice that in all frequency bands, the brain began to act more as a whole. The actual EEG measure is called coherence. It measures the phase relationship of the EEG waves. And what we found is different parts of the brain just started to work more as a whole. The brain started to work more, less as it fragmented areas independently, sending out different responses to acting more as a whole. So these are some things we found with children. And back to, people should look at meditation. Yes, any meditation is very valuable. But you need to be aware that meditations are different. And so just don't take a meditation that it seems to be convenient or easy, but investigate them deeply and look at the immediate and long-term benefits.
Well, this is a good moment to pause. I actually have lots of questions from the points you're making with children, but I'm going to hold on to them. We have to take a bit of a station break, and then we can come back and carry on more of this fascinating conversation. So everyone listening, hang in there. More fascinating information to come. This is Dr. Cheryl Silman. You are listening to What Women Must Know with my guest today, Dr. Fred Travis. Hi, everyone. Welcome back. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You are listening to What Women Must Know. And today we are having another fascinating conversation about topics that can make such a difference in your life. We are talking to Dr. Fred Travis. He is the author of Your Brain is a River, Not a Rock. And he is also the director of the Center for Brain Consciousness and Cognition at the Maharishi Vedic University. And this conversation with children, I'm just curious to know what your thoughts are as to the origin of ADHD. What's, you're affecting the brain waves and you're balancing them out, but what gives rise to these imbalances in the first place? At least, what are your thoughts about that?
Excellent question. Remember, we talked about we're born with our brain unassembled, so the brain is actually dynamically changing over childhood. Attention deficit hyperactive disorder is just a lag in brain development. It's a little bit slower. It's about 3 years behind. But what that means in practice is you're in a class, say, with eighth grade boys. One boy with attention deficit is acting like a fifth grader. And he's acting up, he's talking out, he's standing up looking out the window, he's throwing things. He's not really being bad. He's not intentionally disrupting. It's just that he has the attentional control of a fifth grader. And that's completely unacceptable in the class, and so now we can medicate them. And the medication, they stop the symptoms. Mm-hmm. But it's just a lag in brain development. And what this, what is it due to? Is it due to lutins? Is it due to GMO foods? I mentioned Gabor Maté previously. He thinks it's just part of how the child is coping with their home life. He says if you see a child with ADHD, go to their home and it's completely unorganized. It's completely fast-paced. And so definitely what we're seeing is nature and nurture are coming together. There's found to be some genetic component to ADHD, but also lifestyle stress has an effect. But the point about it is it can be changed by another experience. And what happens, again, during transcendental meditation practice, there's increased blood flow to the front of the brain, decreased blood flow to the brainstem, the part of the brain which has to do with stereotypical behavior and outbursts. That part is more quiet. Part of the brain that has to do with attentional control, that part of the brain is actually more active during TM. So It's almost as though as you're transcending during transcendental meditation, the child is exercising their attention muscle. And so that once they're done practicing TM, they're better able to guide attention afterwards. They as if grow out of their attention deficit hyperactive symptoms.
So it's really accessing a resource that exists within them, within each of us, but we never have been taught how to use it, and therefore we don't really have access to it.
Excellent, excellent overview. Because what we're talking about is experiencing where your thoughts come from. And everyone who thinks a thought, it's come from the source of thought, this inner field of wakefulness. And as you say, our schools don't teach us how to be more quiet. They don't teach us how to be restful and alert. They teach us how to be active, time management, mnemonics, problem-solving skills. It's always thinking and doing. What is happening, though, is educators are realizing the importance of this experience of restful alertness, and they're beginning to include it into their daily routine. San Francisco, the administration of San Francisco school system has started a number of pilot projects, and they've introduced transcendental meditation in the form of quiet time into their middle schools, and they're finding that middle schools that before would have shootings and killings and police to actually check you as you go in and out of class, that they've become quiet, peaceful, and the students have actually excelled in their grades. Because every student wants to grow and be the best that they can, and if it's frustrated, that's where it creates a collision, and that's where it creates wrong behavior. And if a student comes in who's under stress, who maybe was bullied on the way to school, maybe at home there was an argument, maybe there was some alcoholic he had to walk over to come to school, all of that is in the child's brain when they come to school. And if they can sit and transcend, it is as if washes that off. And so the mind that comes back into class is just quiet, awake, alert, and ready to go. This quiet time program has been very successful, and it's well engineered because it's not a meditation program, because some parents might have some feelings one way or the other. It's a quiet time. So for 10 minutes, morning and afternoon, the school is quiet. There's no announcements. Nobody's talking. And if you know transcendental meditation, you can close your eyes and meditate. If you don't know transcendental meditation, you sit and read a book quietly. Which, by the way, also has benefits.
Well, I'd love to see a program like that incorporated in every school in the country. What a fantastic gift it would give to the students.
Yes.
I'm sure you're working on it as best as you can. Let's talk about meditation and healing. Healing
yes.
the body.
Well, probably the first point is to realize that the body is not a machine. And so if something's wrong, you just take one part out and stick another part in. But rather, the body, the mind and body are really one. Every time you have an experience, which is a conscious mental experience, it's transformed into chemicals. It's transformed into different neurotransmitters in the body. It's transformed into different automatic responses in the autonomic nervous system. It's transformed into different brain circuits. And so the conscious experience is actually constructing the physiology. And so how we see the world is very much depending if we're healthy or not. There was a epidemiological study done on 2,000 individuals at the university, and they all practiced transcendental meditation, and they were all had Blue Cross Blue Shield insurance. And they compared them with individuals at universities in the Midwest, small universities. And what they found is there was an 80% decrease in hospital use and incidence of disease in those people who are practicing transcendental meditation. A lot of it is just that if you see something as stress, that's how the body responds. And when you practice transcendental meditation and the mind is more quiet, more alert, you experience yourself as more whole, more complete. When you go back into the world, things just have less of an effect on you. That which was before stressful is now just a challenge. So that's one point about how it's working. The other point about how it's working is the idea of deficiency versus growth motivation, something that Abraham Maslow has come up with. And that if you see a situation as possibly threatening, as possibly life-threatening to you, that's how you'll respond. You respond to some deficiency. I need some help to fill up this hole. But if you see that you're growing, you see that I'm not complete, I'm not where I want to be at the moment, but I'm in the process of growing, and then again, the whole body is different. And so there's a very strong psychoneuroimmunology. There's a very strong scientifically validated relationship between psychology, how we see the world, and how the immune function is, how the immune system is functioning. Any stress decreases the immune response. What schools often find around finals, that's when their students are getting sick, because the stress of finals is decreasing the immune functioning and it's letting them fall prey to all the bacteria and stuff that's around here. And what we find with transcendental meditation, the stress, first the sympathetic nervous system is less active, and that's the fight or flight response. And because the sympathetic nervous system is less active, we're seeing that blood pressure is lower, because blood pressure is caused by increased sympathetic activation. Because the sympathetic activation is down, you're less reactive in situations. Not meaning that you're passive and slow to react, but you don't overreact. Two interesting studies have looked at this. They've looked at how the sympathetic activation system responds using skin conductance. One looked at people were watching a movie, and the movie was of a shop, a machine shop, and as you got closer, you could see that there was going to be an accident. The guy would severely injure himself. And so they looked at people practicing TM and controls. What they found is that the people practicing TM, they actually responded quicker and to a greater degree than the control subjects, but then they came back to rest afterwards. And when they were asked about the research, they said, yeah, it was pretty terrible. But the control subjects were a little bit of PTSD. They said, well, this was a horrible experiment. I don't think it's ethical that you made us do this, and so on and so on. Because if you're stressed, everything that you experience is more intense. Everything that you experience, even though it's a little change, because your baseline of stress is high, it makes it much more intense. And so in these ways, transcending helps people be more healthy. And there's one other way. When the mind is settling down and the body has a state of restful alertness, and the brain has a state of restful alertness where increased blood flow to the front of the brain, decreased to the brainstem, what's happening to the body is the body's self-referral mechanisms are being enlivened. Because our body is not a mechanical machine. It's a series of self-referral loops which are trying to maintain homeostasis, maintain constant growth. And these self-referral loops are what get pushed out of kilter by stress, by lack of sleep, lack of exercise, bad food. And what transcending does, it seems to help to reset these. One example is sympathetic activation. It's typically higher in non-meditating individuals. You close your eyes, you transcend, sympathetic activation goes down. And then when you come out of meditation, it remains low. So you have a more stable basis to see the world. But you're able to respond more quickly because it's like a calm pool of water that can reflect things around you. But then you come back to rest again. It's a whole different style of functioning. In terms of styles of functioning, there used to be two, stabile and labile. Stabile is a John Wayne type, you know, nothing bothers me. And labile is the very eccentric person, lots of ideas, always flying off the handle. But what we're finding is there's a third type, and that's an adaptive person, where they're able to be more rested, like a stable person. But when it's time to respond, they can respond quickly and to a large extent. That is, they can activate, allocate resources to deal with a problem, and then they can come back to rest again. And I think all of these together describe how transcendental meditation has very profound effects on health and also on healing.
And how about aging? What's the? How does meditation support healthy aging?
That's a great question. First, the bigger picture. Up through age 25, DNA information is governing changes in the brain. After age 25, it's people's decisions which govern brain circuits. So you probably know, you see someone who's actually age 40, and they could look 20 or they can look 60. It all depends on the choices that they make.
Oh, can you just say that again? Just repeat that, because that's really profound.
Yeah.
But under 25, the brain is developing on its own. Is that what you said?
Look, just to expand that a little bit, up to age 25, there's an inborn program in the DNA which goes on. First, there's an increase of brain connection from 0 to 3. It remains high from 3 to 10. Then there's a process of pruning from 10 to 18. At the same time, the connections between different areas are gaining a fatty coat. It's called myelin. So the information flow is more effective between those areas. So this is inborn. This is in everyone's DNA, and it happens in anyone wherever they're born. By age 25, this process is finished. So then what determines our brain connections are our choices, because our choices lead to experience. The experience then strengthens those same circuits. So after age 25, you are very much in control. And that was why I said if you see someone who's 40, they could look 20 and they could look 60. And it's the difference between chronological age, how old they are, and their biological age. And a lot of it is the choices they've made. And some of the choices are for rest, for exercise, for good food. Part of the choices is transcending, stepping out of time and space and just being, and then coming back into time and space. And the whole orientation of the mind is different. And I think it's critical that if your mind is 40, your body can be 80, and you'll be thinking and acting like a 40-year-old. So this is on a conceptual brain level, looking at actually what's been done. They've looked at people practicing transcendental meditation, and The longer you've been practicing TM, the bigger the difference between your chronological and biological age. So it was a 14-year difference with those people practicing transcendental meditation for 12 years or longer. And this was using standard physiological measures of aging, like near-point vision, blood pressure, reaction time, and so on. Now there's work on telomere length. What telomeres are the ends of the DNA. It holds the DNA together. And what they've looked at is not only the physical end, but also the enzyme which is there, which can repair it, called telomerase. And there's research showing that stress, abuse, especially with children, leads to decreased telomerase and shorter length of telomeres. There's also some early work now with different meditation practice and how they're affecting telomere length. So the process of aging is interesting, because science really doesn't know why we age. They have different theories of it. But definitely I see it's the lifestyle choices you make that determine how young you really are.
Well, I find that pretty fascinating, because I'm all for lengthening my telomeres at this point in my life. But you know, when I hear you talk about these amazing resources we all have within us and what is required are the keys to release them, unlock them, or make them available, And it just becomes such an obvious thing how important it is to bring these resources into our lives to allow us to thrive and to rejuvenate, regenerate, or allow our kids to be all that they can be. And it's just nice to see we're arriving at a time where we can integrate more of these tools into our lives, into our culture, to allow us to access the potentials that we all have. But we need these tools to really unlock them so they can become present in our lives.
That is extremely clear. I agree with you 100%.
You know, I work a lot with women, and I personally believe that for women, because we're more vulnerable to stress, our brains are more vulnerable, our hormones are more vulnerable, that for women, especially, well, I think it's true for women of all ages, and the older we get, the more vulnerable we become, because the more we tend to be out of balance and toxic and compromised functioning for a number of reasons, that meditation is really not an option for women. I believe everyone should be meditating. You can choose the path that works for you, but it's only going to enhance the quality of one's life and one's health and this other aspect of healthy aging right now.
Absolutely. I think what we have with women, first, I'll say the obvious, women are different from men, and they're different on how the brain is connected. And some of the differences, the connections with the emotional system for women are more to the frontal lobes, to your executive center. So women are typically more in touch with their emotions. Men, the limbic system is more, it has more physical connections to the brainstem. So if you ask a guy how they're feeling, he'll say, oh yeah, I'm fine. You ask a girl how she's feeling, and she's able to go into the fine gradations of it. I think that's part of it. It's as though men have a very almost crude 0-1 for their emotions, where women have very fine gradations. Also what happens is men and women respond to stress differently. And physiologically, with both sexes, it's cortisol and adrenaline. Adrenaline revs things up, cortisol turns off the immune system so you can get going. But women as well, what you find is oxytocin. This is recent work by Taylor. And what oxytocin does is it decreases the magnitude of the sympathetic activation. And also, oxytocin is a trust hormone. So under stress, what men do is they tend to get less verbal, they tend to get more task-oriented, and they just deal with the emergency. And it's great. It needs to be done. But it's not the only response to stress. You also have to figure out, how's everybody doing? Does anyone need hot water or coffee? How's the kids? Should we call someone and tell them? And the response of the women is to do that. It's more person-oriented, where with men it's more task-oriented. And I think this difference is not respected. And so guys trying to want girls to be like them when they respond to stress. And the normal response of the woman to stress isn't honored. And I think some of this is just turned back in, so the woman internalizes it. And then that, I think, is what gives rise to disease and so on. Just an angle from a man. I don't know how valid it is.
Oh, no, I think it's very valid, because we are created neurologically different, as well as other differences, but we need to understand and appreciate those differences and support each other and enhance the qualities that are, you know, the males or the females may have, even though it may not be innate. We can bring them forth. We've come to the end of the show. Is it best to give people your website, drfredtravis.com? Would that be your preferred website?
Yes, that would be good. And that has a list of my articles and also an email to contact me.
Yeah, it has great information. I've been up there. Dr. Fred Travis, thank you for such an enlightening conversation today. And just love the work you're doing.
Talking with you. Thank you, Cheryl, for all that you're doing. All the best.
Bye now. And thank you for your listening participation today. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. Remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self.